Hello and welcome to the second in the series of embryology podcasts for the Swansea University's Graduate Entry Programme. My name's Dr. Sam Webster again. This is the first real lecture in the series, and it's a very introductory lecture where we talk about concepts and very much an introduction to embryology and development in general. So in this lecture we'll talk about what embryology, what the embryo is, what development is, timing of pregnancy and that sort of thing, and then we'll talk about some of the principles of growth and development, and then we'll talk about growth. I'll mention differentiation and organization, and this shouldn't take too long, and this will lead us into future lectures in the series. So you may be picking up a few words today which might be fairly new. There is a glossary that accompanies this lecture. A lot of the words I'll be using in this lecture, if you haven't heard them before, will be words we'll probably be using quite a lot in the future in this module, in this lecture series, and in other aspects of medicine. So let's begin. Really we're talking about in embryology and development, how do we go from a single cell, or two cells, the egg and the sperm, to the fertilized egg? How do we go from that to what we see as ourselves, adult humans? Development continues for about 20 years after birth. We don't stop growing until we're 18 to 21 years old. We're still getting taller, we're still getting bigger and so on. And then of course many processes continue after that. So how do we go from a single cell to the large multicellular organism that we see sat here today? Let's give a bit of history. Back in the 4th century BC, Aristotle put forward a couple of ideas. Quite clear, sensible ideas about how we develop. One, everything in the embryo was preformed and simply got bigger. That is to say that the adult human was a very, very, very small human in the embryo, and just got bigger during gestation and then obviously bigger after birth. His second idea was that new structures arise progressively through epigenesis, so suggesting that we don't look like a tiny miniature human originally, but new structures develop and change shape and grow to give the baby and the adult human that we see. He favoured epigenesis, his second theory, and he was indeed correct. It's pretty good for 2,500 years ago. In the 17th century, though, when the strong belief of divine creation was around, the idea that all embryos had always existed and that the first embryo of a species contained all the future embryos was believed by the majority to be the correct idea. So this was real creationist stuff, that everything that will exist always had existed. That first embryo contained all the future embryos, all the future animals of that species. This was taken to the point that during the development of microscopes and so on, some said that within each sperm they could see a tiny human, a homunculus, and that was taken as evidence for this theory. They could actually see in the head of each human sperm a tiny human. Of course, with cell theory in the 1830s, when Schleiden and Schwann came together, a botanist and a physiologist, and looked at the structure of organisms under microscopes, they saw that all living organisms are made up of cells, which are the basic units of life and arise only by division of other cells. So they showed that, or it was shown that, the egg is just a single but very specialized cell from which the embryo develops. Therefore, epigenetic theory must be right. So be careful what you think you can see under a microscope, or generally be careful what you think you can see. Okay, so moving on. So we progress from the fertilized egg to a shape that resembles an adult over actually 8 weeks after fertilization. So those first 8 weeks are the embryonic period. During those first 8 weeks, we don't really look much like our adult selves, but at the end of the 8 weeks, we do. We have fingers and toes, arms and legs. You can pretty much see ears and eyes and so on. So after those 8 weeks, then a lot of what's happening is we're getting bigger, and there's a lot of development ongoing, sure, but those general shapes, the general shape of the adult is laid down in the first 8 weeks. In fact, in those first 8 weeks, particularly in the early stages, a human embryo looks very much similar to a mouse embryo, a bovine embryo, an equine embryo, all sorts. Embryos look very, very similar until the end of those 8 weeks, where in fact they've changed shape, they've picked up a lot of the adult structures and shapes, and they look quite different. So, in the first 8 weeks, the structures of most systems are established. As I said, fingers and toes are clear examples. You can also see arms and legs, knees and elbows, the ear, the eyelids become unfused. The tail disappears. Yes, we have a tail, and it disappears after the first 8 weeks. And at that stage, the head is about half the total length of the embryo if you measure from the crown to the rump, so not measuring the legs. Most of the internal systems are complete, if not actually functioning yet. The embryo is obviously very much dependent on the mother. And at this stage, we have an embryo that's about 5 centimeters from crown to rump. Most then of what we talk about in these embryology lectures are the first 8 weeks of development. When we talk about embryology, we talk about the first 8 weeks of the embryo's life. So then the fetal stage is from 8 weeks until birth. There is a slowdown in the growth of the head relative to the rest of the body. A lot of what's going on, as I said, is the fetus getting larger. So it rapidly gets longer, particularly in the fourth and fifth months. So in the fifth month, the mother starts to feel movement. By that stage, the fetus is about 15 centimeters long, and the fetus is getting larger and larger, putting on weight. And towards the end of gestation, towards the end of pregnancy, is when the fetus puts on weight at the fastest rate. There's an interesting difference between embryology and pregnancy, or let's say embryology and scientific and clinical terms, which isn't unusual. Talking about the timing of pregnancy. Now, when I talk about the first 8 weeks of the embryo's development, I'm talking obviously about the first 8 weeks from fertilization to 8 weeks after fertilization. However, although development starts at the point of fertilization, that point is very difficult to identify in real life. In fact, fertilization isn't a point, it's a process that takes around 22 to 24 hours. There is no point of fertilization. It's a long process. But that's by the by. We'll talk about that in, I think, next lecture. Now, in real life, missing a menstrual period is the obvious indicator of pregnancy. So, clinically, pregnancy is commonly timed from the last menstrual period. In embryology, the development of the embryo is calculated from the point of fertilization. Fertilization, or the point of fertilization, is typically 2 weeks before the next expected menstrual period. So it's the point of fertilization is 2 weeks after the last menstrual period. So, we might measure the development of the embryo and the fetus as a 30-week, 38-week gestational period, as scientists. But in the clinic, the gestational period is 40 weeks because we have an extra 2 weeks on at the beginning, measuring the length of the pregnancy from the last menstrual period. So 38 weeks versus 40 clinical weeks. There are variations in the lengths of pregnancies. There's a variation between individuals. There are variations within an individual between first and subsequent babies. There are variations between races and so on, but these are averages. We're looking at around 40-week gestation from the last menstrual period for most people. The mean length for different groups can vary by up to about 10 days. Okay, so let's briefly mention the menstrual cycle before we talk about timing and calculating timing of pregnancies. So the menstrual cycle, which you'll meet in a number of lectures most likely because it's absolutely core knowledge. The menstrual cycle consists of changes to the endometrial layer of the uterus. So that's to the most external layer of the uterus. Changes are under the control of the pituitary gland and of the ovary via hormones, which, as I say, we'll cover in detail later. But there are a number of stages. The average cycle length is 28 days. There's a range of 21 to 40 days, but on average it's around 28 days. And the stages from menstruation are a reparative phase, proliferative phase, ovulation, secretory phase, and menstruation. So obviously during menstruation, the lining of the uterus is shed. And then the reparative phase makes sense in that that lining begins to become restored. The proliferative phase is the lining of the uterus is getting thicker and various glands and what have you are starting to appear. Ovulation then occurs 14 days before menstruation starts. Okay, let's say that if a menstrual cycle is 28 days, then ovulation is 14 days after menstruation, fine. But if the cycle length varies, then ovulation is most accurately stated as being 14 days before menstruation starts. That is to say that the first half of the cycle, or the first part of the cycle, is more variable in length. The last part of the cycle is more consistently 14 days between different women. Anyway, ovulation then occurs once the endometrial lining has been restored. And if fertilization was to occur, then sometime after ovulation, the developing embryo would implant into the uterine wall during the secretory phase. And if this doesn't happen, then at the end of the secretory phase, the endometrial lining is lost during menstruation. You will probably hear slightly different terms for the phases of the menstrual cycle and slightly different descriptions, but they're all describing the same thing, the same series of processes. And it will all make more sense when we discuss it in terms of hormones, and then you can understand it in your own mind in terms of hormones rather than descriptive terms. Okay, so back to length of pregnancy then. We're going from the date of the last menstrual period. So we then have 2 weeks-ish after that, the fertilization must have occurred. 38 weeks would be 9.5 lunar months. The 40 weeks from the last menstrual period would be 10 lunar months. 10 lunar months is about 7 days longer than 9 calendar months. So there's a quick calculation you can do to guesstimate the due date, which would be you take the date of the last menstrual period, you add 9 calendar months, and add 7 days, and that will give you fairly accurately the due date for delivery. In fact, if you just take this in terms of the calendar, this is correct in more than half the calendar cases and is at worst only out by 3 days too many. Biology is far more variable than that. Okay, so going back to fetal periods, there is another point which you should be aware of, which is the law with regarding to the fetus during pregnancy. After 24 weeks of pregnancy, the fetus is considered viable by law. So, the delivery of a dead fetus before 24 weeks of pregnancy is considered a miscarriage or an abortion. The delivery of a dead fetus after 24 weeks is treated as stillbirth. That fetus is treated as an individual that has lived and died and must be registered as such. There is some discussion at the moment about changes to the law and reduction of this point to 16 weeks, so pay attention to that. I think this debate's been going on for 18 months or a couple of years or so and hasn't come through yet. Modern treatments, as I'm sure you've read and you've probably seen, mean that in practice, a fetus born at 20 to 22 weeks may be viable. The chances of survival of a fetus of that age may be slim, but it's possible that that baby may survive with modern methods, modern clinical practice. Survival actually at this age depends more on size than on age. And in the later stages of the pregnancy, as I said, the fetus is putting on weight more rapidly. So the odds of survival increase with each week that the fetus remains in utero. But survival from 20 weeks is quite possible these days. Let's move on then to actual principles of growth and development themselves. So we're moving from the zygote to the embryo, to the fetus, to the newborn. Changes in size are accompanied by changes in shape and proportion. I'm sure you've seen children, I mean children versus adults obviously, in that the heads of children are much larger in proportion to their bodies than adults. In fact, one's head doesn't grow that much during childhood and adolescence compared to the body, which grows a great deal from birth to adulthood. So changes in size accompanying changes in shape and proportion shouldn't be an unusual idea to you. We'll talk about the processes by which these changes occur. We'll talk about differentiation and organization and morphogenesis. Okay. So if we're going to talk about growth, growth happens largely after the patterning and differentiation, and the rate of growth then will affect the shape. So there are three methods of growth. If growth is an increase in the mass or overall size of a tissue or an organism, growth can occur through an increase in cell number, an increase in cell size, or an increase in extracellular material. And this sort of growth is commonly seen in adult tissues as well as in development. So in proliferation, a cell divides. You get one cell, divides into two, those two cells become like the parent cell. And this is the most common method of growth. This is a method of growth that doesn't occur in skeletal tissue, differentiated skeletal tissue, or cardiac muscle, or neurons. These cell types won't divide. What we have once they're differentiated is what we've got. But in other tissues, proliferation, increase in cell number, gives an increase in tissue size. Hypertrophy. In hypertrophy, the cell itself gets larger. You see this all the time with skeletal muscle fibers. Partly the increase in size of a muscle is due to increased vascularization, but in response to weight training, skeletal muscle fibers will hypertrophy. The muscle fibers won't increase in number, they won't proliferate, they will increase in size, they will hypertrophy. So the muscle gets bigger. And the third method then, accretion. The cell secretes an extracellular matrix around itself, pushing itself away from neighbouring cells. This is very common in cartilage and bone, whereby the tissue may increase in size through proliferation. You may get some cell division, but the biggest changes in the size of the tissue come with accretion. The cells are making more and more extracellular matrix and making more and more tissue, so the tissue gets bigger and bigger. And of course, in cartilage and bone, the extracellular matrix is very important because they're structural tissues. So the extracellular matrix is the structure, is the tough tissue. Growth is actually not common in many adult tissues, but it can occur in response to, as we've seen, training or in response to injury. So growth is common as a repair response, but by the adult stage, we've pretty much done all our growing. Another process that's important But it's kind of the opposite of cell growth or of growth is cell death. There is control over cell death within the body and during development, and apoptosis is a name for programmed cell death, deliberate cell suicide. And apoptosis can be important in forming shapes. One good example is the formation of the hand, which during development is initially like a paddle, and in between the future digits, the cells are triggered to die, to go undergo a very programmed, very clean cell death and package themselves away very neatly, to form the gaps between the digits, and then the digits become distinguishable. So cell death is also important in growth and development. So that's growth. Let's also talk about some of the processes that we're more likely to talk about in embryology, such as differentiation. Differentiation is a process by which cells acquire a cell type. A cell becomes specialized. So, before differentiation, you would have a stem cell or a stem type cell, a cell that could potentially become any cell in the body or a wide range of cells. It would be totipotent or pluripotent. With differentiation, the stem cell would become a specialized cell. So it would go down a pathway which would make it into a cartilage cell or a muscle cell or a neuron. And as it progresses down that pathway, it develops a clear identity and will reach a point at which it cannot differentiate any further. It's reached a point of terminal differentiation. And at that point, it's usually a very specialized cell with a very specialized function. A neuron is quite different to a muscle cell. A muscle cell is quite different to a cartilage cell. Once they've differentiated, that cell type is very stable. If the cell were to divide, it would pass on its cell type. And this is what most of the body is made up of, differentiated cells. And there are more than 200 differentiated cell types in mammals. So you can see the advantage of stem cells and progenitor cells. If we can isolate stem cells, we can encourage them to differentiate into different cells needed during repair processes or whatever under different conditions. So we can take these stem cells, get them to proliferate or divide, and then differentiate into that specialized cell type that we need to repair whatever process we need to repair. Another important part of embryology then is organization. So by organization, I'm talking about cells getting organized to make something. So pattern formation, organized to develop something a lot more complex. For example, pattern formation occurs in the developing arm, which starts off as a limb bud. So if we hark back to the example used for apoptosis, how does a cell in the developing arm know to become part of a finger or part of the upper arm or part of the radius or the ulna or a nerve? If all these cells start off as almost stem cells, how do they know to do the job that they should do to form the adult structure that we see as the forearm? The method is the cell has positional knowledge. It knows where it is, so it's told where it is, so it's told what to do. Body plans are laid down, so a cell within a structure such as the developing arm, there would be a dorsal ventral axis, a caudal cephalic axis, a proximodistal axis. So there would be a three-dimensional three axes giving three-dimensional information to a cell so it knew where it was, knew what it had to do. Cells signal to other cells via induction. A signal from one group of cells will influence the development of an adjacent group of cells. There are many different types of signals. There are lots of genes encoding lots of signaling proteins. And there are different ways in which that signal can travel from one cell to another. It might be a signal that travels a long way, all the way across the limb, for example, or maybe a signal that travels a very short distance just to some neighbouring cells. And on the receiving cell, that cell must have receptors to pick up that signal. So not all cells may be affected by a signal. And a signal, again, may have positive or negative effects on that cell. It may tell it to do something, or it may tell it to stop doing something. So by cells signaling to other cells, they can, in a fairly complex and comprehensive manner, control the development of quite detailed structures. Okay, so if we're talking about the limb, and we'll talk about this again when you have your musculoskeletal embryology lecture, but on the anteroposterior gradient, so ventral dorsal gradient, so from the, say, the back of the limb to the front of the limb, the cells on the back surface produce a factor that diffuses across that developing limb. So we're thinking of a bud here, a really simple limb that's extending out from the side of the embryo. The fingers and what have you haven't developed yet. And they're producing a factor that is going to signal to lots of other cells, and it's diffusing across the limb. So at the around the site of the cells which are producing this factor, the concentration is very high. As the factor diffuses across the limb, the concentration drops off. And the cells that can detect this factor will respond differently to the different concentrations of the factor. So the concentration and the diffusion is very important. And this sort of work has been demonstrated on developing chick limb buds, so that if you were to take those cells which are making the signal and graft them onto the opposite side of the developing limb, so you have two signal sources diffusing across the limb, so you'd have two high concentration areas and a low concentration area in the middle, you get some quite strange developmental responses to that signal. The cells then think that they're on the other side of the limb. They think they're on the back of the limb instead of the front of the limb. So depending upon which stage you add these signals, you get a duplication. So for example, you could get a duplication of the digits. So on the developing chick limb, you'd have, instead of the three obvious digits, you'd have a mirror image of those digits, because the cells thought that they were on the other side of the limb, so they've then gone on to develop some of the digits on the wrong side of the limb, twice as many limbs. So, okay, we're almost to the end of this lecture now. Another term we should talk about with development, one of the principles of development, is morphogenesis, meaning the generation of form. A formless lump, a big lump of cells, forms into a recognizable shape. That's morphogenesis. Happens all the time in development. So going from a flat layer of cells to form into a tube, which will then be the gut, that would be morphogenesis, for example. And morphogenesis occurs through cells migrating, changes in cell adhesion, so that, say, flat sheets of cells will then form different shapes because adhesion of different parts changes. And again, we'll talk about this later when we talk about gastrulation and development of the gut and so on. And migration is again induced by environmental cues, by signals from other cells, and also by differences in adhesion between neighbouring cells and different cells. So there's a good example, which I think is in a picture here, is of the sea urchin, which is a nice simple organism early on, and goes from a blob of cells, as it were. The endoderm layer invaginates to form a hollow tube, which then passes all the way through the urchin embryo. So it's gone from a hollow sphere to a hollow sphere with a tube running through it. It's changed shape. That's morphogenesis. It now has the basis of a gut. So there we go. We've covered growth, differentiation, patterning, and morphogenesis in that last part. We also covered the stages of the embryo and the fetus, and we introduced the menstrual cycle and spoke a little bit about the length of pregnancy or so on. So that's a brief introduction. The next lecture will be the first 18 days of the embryo, which starts around the time of fertilization and talks about what happens to that embryo as it goes from a single cell to a mass of cells implanting into the uterus. And we should be using some of these concepts that we've mentioned today in that lecture, and certainly in future lectures. And we'll talk about this in a lot more detail. And the detail, unfortunately, will pick up very, very quickly. So for those of you who already have a background in this sort of area, this was very straightforward, but I'm trying to bring you all up to the same foundation level. In future, when Dr. Bishop comes back, she also teaches on the embryology part of the course. Hopefully we'll both record on these podcasts and might make it a little bit more interesting, probably with bickering and so on. But it's hard work for me talking on my own, and probably a little bit boring for you as well. But I'll see you next in the first 18 days of embryology lecture.